Disrespect likes to make light where government ineptitude, indifference, envy or malice don't threaten our lives and simply look silly. But this is about a little girl whose life was threatened and ultimately taken. And this has recently been replicated when a boy a little over 1 year old died in foster care in the same town in Alberta in the last week or two. The mother is still trying to find out if this is the same facility that so neglected her daughter. This is one of the toughest interviews that I've had to produce, although the conversation was straightforward, and I don't present it here to inflict the mother's suffering on you, but simply to share it with you. And this is my own point of view, not the station's, not even the mother's. But you know, every time we engage the euphemism that government means well or doesn't intend to hurt people, that this is maybe not even mostly the truth, certainly not always the truth. So with no more to say, I'll give you Velvet Martin.
Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them.
Disrespect introduces Velvet Martin, the mother of five children, one of whom was taken into care for disability supports and died on emerging from government care at age 13. Her name is Samantha. Welcome to the show, Velvet.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that people are caring to look into the needs of children with disabilities.
All right. We had a number of news items on deaths of children in foster care. It's your feeling that not only should this stop, children no longer should have to go by legislation into foster care for disability supports, but they're dying in increasing numbers.
Yes, absolutely. Within the past week, there have been two children within Alberta who have passed away in foster care. One died yesterday in hospital, shaken baby syndrome.
Yeah. The papers seem to have picked this up as an unwanted trend, which is maybe hopeful.
I hope so, because maybe it will force accountability.
Has the Wild Rose Party picked up on it?
I believe they have, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You don't know the form that that's taken yet, though, eh?
No. Generally, there's a lot of silencing. Immediately, what happens is the FOIP laws come into effect. And
what does?
FOIP, Freedom of Information Policy.
Yeah. Okay.
Which states that in order to protect the victims, they do not release the names. Unfortunately,
okay,
that also serves to protect the wrongdoers, and the victims needed protection in life, not in death.
Yeah, that's true. How long ago did your daughter die?
Samantha passed away on December 3rd, 2006.
Okay.
We're still awaiting answers.
Yeah. And it's still a heavy burden for you.
Tremendously.
Yeah. Why don't you tell, if you can, why don't you tell the listener, well, you told me a story about how the government views this incident with your child. Why don't you tell us that for a start, and then tell us how you felt since her death?
There are no answers forthcoming. just prior to interviewing with you, I attempted to call the minister's office to find out about the recent death of this child that had died. I was placed on hold for 8 minutes, and then an answering machine came on and stating that they were all too busy to answer. But last week when I called the minister's office, the executive assistant, when I pursued my questions, which I had been promised, hung up the phone in my ear.
Okay. You dealt with a prosecutor, too, who had an unfortunate view of the incident that affected you most directly.
Yes, there is a public fatality inquiry that's pending for my daughter. The solicitor who will represent the case and bring it before a judge refers to persons with disability as those who necessarily suffer.
Mm.
Samantha suffered when she was not treated correctly. Otherwise, Samantha was a very happy, loving child.
Mm-hmm.
She was not a suffering individual.
Right.
Furthermore, during one of the court proceedings, I asked the court to please take notice that in the future, with parents who have lost a child, not to refer to the child as the deceased, but to please give them a name, provide the human aspect, and at least afford them their name.
Yeah.
Shortly after that, the solicitor stood up and referred to my child as it. It died.
I see. A
13-year-old. And that's who's representing the courts of Alberta.
Okay. How have you felt since this started? It sounds like you felt almost brutalized.
It very much feels that way, Jeff. It's re-victimization all over again. I mean, we've been coming forward, trying to access help for our child since she was alive.
Right.
Reporting what we found to be concerning evidences, and apparently other sources were reporting the same to authorities, and nothing was done. Mm-hmm. We reported 3 years prior to our daughter's death, and we were repeatedly told everything is fine.
Oh, 3 years you were reporting abuse?
Yes.
I see. And you were ignored?
Mm-hmm.
And even put off?
Mm-hmm. And following our daughter's death, we were able to access medical and educational files, the educational logs. Horrendous, just page after page of our daughter coming to school with bruises, with filthy clothing, with mold on her bread.
Really?
Really. We're not making allegations. We're just bringing forward what witnesses have actually brought to authorities. We want answers. Why? Yeah. Why was this allowed to continue?
And your daughter was released from foster care at age 13, what, at your request?
Yes. Well, as I say, we've been requesting this for some time. When our daughter entered under a foster agreement, this was never a case where our family was deemed to be inappropriate. We were nothing but viewed as a loving family. The
right.
sole reason to access government supports was the archaic legislation which saw children with disabilities grouped amongst children who may have been harmed by their families.
Right.
In doing so, basically, we lost all of our parental rights. They were eroded. Each time we tried to access visits with our daughter, we were told that at the last minute that they were canceled. So we would wonder why, you know, is our daughter all right?
Mm-hmm.
Can somebody please go at least and check on her?
Yeah.
Terrible. My daughter suffered, according to the medical records we were able to pull up, 7 broken limbs.
Ooh.
3 of them which were femurs.
Mm-hmm.
We were always told in response to the broken bones that our daughter had weak bone syndrome. However, another file that was brought up from the medical community indicates that a bone scan states that her chronological age matched perfectly with her her bone age. There was no reason why there should be breaks. And once Samantha was out of the environment, she didn't suffer any injuries.
I see. So how long did you try to get her out?
From the 3 years, we kept saying, can we have the same supports and services in order to help our child at home? Repeatedly, we would be told, I don't know, you'll have to, I don't know, check in. Nobody seemed to know. Nobody seemed to know the law. And part of the reason why it took so long to release our daughter out of this situation was the archaic legislation. Nobody knew what to do with us.
Right.
This legislation, apparently, we were told in the autumn before our daughter came home by Children's Services that we were one of four in across the province of Alberta who were under this archaic legislation of a permanent guardianship agreement.
I see.
They didn't know what to do with us. They had to bring in their own legal advisors to find out how to get rid of this law. It was not until our daughter lay in the hospital dying that a manager revealed the truth to us. We had been lied to by our caseworker throughout our daughter's entire life. We were told that there was a three-way guardianship split between the government, ourselves, and the foster placement,
right,
in which the supervisor had that 1% extra say, and we were told to be quiet, not to rock the boat.
Right.
And upon our daughter's death, we learned that that wasn't the truth at all. Actually, we were the only guardians.
Oh, really? So they basically had to do what you told them. But they didn't tell you that, and you didn't know.
Right.
Okay. So your daughter came home. What happened between then and when she died?
Our beautiful little girl immediately gained 10 pounds. She had hovered at age, up until age 12, at 50 pounds. 3 years in a row, she weighed 50 pounds. She was always starving when she came to visit us. We couldn't figure it out. We thought perhaps she might have an inability to understand satiation. That was not the case whatsoever.
Inability to understand what?
Being satiated, the feeling of being full.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So when she came home, it was within a month's time. When she had her fill, she would push away the food. She knew that there was more coming.
Okay.
Beyond that, she learned how to toilet for daytime continence.
She hadn't learned that up until age 12 at the foster care.
No.
Okay.
No. And she was so thrilled, her little face, when we bought her little panties, little girl panties. She was so proud of herself.
Yeah.
Also, our daughter was nonverbal up until she came home.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly she started to speak.
Really?
She could say mom. She called her dad mom, too. And no matter how many times we told her notes, dad, 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 and she'd say mom and start to laugh. She learned to say her breath. She did. She was, and I think she knew, too.
Yeah, she has a sense of humor.
She did. She was actually, she had a great sense of humor. She could say good morning. She could say good night. She learned, there's no telling how far she could have gone.
Right.
In that short period of time, we tried to keep as much of her background as possible, not to change things. So we kept the same schools, the same programs, the same physicians wherever possible.
Right.
And Samantha's teachers all referred to her when she came home as a butterfly who suddenly emerged from her cocoon.
Oh, wow.
She did wonderful.
And now we'll take a short break with Hamilton's own Steve Strongman, River.
Won't somebody help me, if you please? My baby's gone with the breeze. River, river, carry me far from my home. To my baby, where can she be? Oh, I'm all alone. Thank you. I'm all alone. I'm all alone.
You've been listening to Velvet Martin, the mother of a 13-year-old daughter who died after being released from foster care, but whose evidence of abuse has never brought a response from government in Alberta. What happened to her health?
Her health was wonderful. The social workers, the doctors, everybody said, wow, she's doing amazing. Right. She was obviously severely repressed.
Yeah.
We began to suspect, speaking with the school and our own views, that our daughter was possibly having seizure activity.
Well,
there were other health issues that we were addressing as well, but the seizure activity was one. We underwent EEGs, which were inconclusive. So we were scheduled to go in for a second one under sedation.
A second one?
On November 30th. We had a well check with our pediatrician.
Right.
Just prior to this, and in the office visit, we sat with the teacher who wanted to come along as well. Our doctor, our pediatrician, witnessed our daughter have a seizure.
Okay.
She was sitting on the exam table and looked up at the fluorescent lights, and her eyes began to flicker back and forth rapidly. And we knew immediately. The doctor said, this is a witness seizure, and we were to start medication directly after the EEG under sedation.
Okay.
The day before, our little girl had breakfast, went off to school, went bowling with her class, won the game, and at lunchtime, when she returned to the school, the teacher said her face just suddenly went pale. She was white, and she began to make retching noises as if she was going to vomit. So Samantha came home. I watched her the whole day, talked with the hospital, wondering whether they would call off the procedure the next day, and they just said, just keep watching her today, and they'll make the decision tomorrow. Samantha seemed well. I kept her actually upright so that I was afraid that she might vomit if she was laying down sleeping. And in the early evening, our eldest son called to us and said, Mom, Samantha's not answering me. And she had collapsed. We rushed to the hospital, and they said that she was in cardiac arrest. And within days, her little body could not make it back, and she passed away.
I see. So basically from unmedicated seizures is what you suspect?
I strongly suspect.
Yeah.
I strongly suspect that that's what happened.
But the government's been worse than no help. They've obscured the issue by refusing to release any information.
Absolutely. We were, and this is a prime example, in trying to access one more medical file that's under government direction on medical facility, we followed all the protocol to FOIP the records, and as nothing was coming, all of a sudden we got a telephone call from an information officer who explained that he was very sorry, but they found some type of loophole that stated that once a child dies, basically guardianship ends, which means that we were no longer considered the guardians, the parents, and not entitled to our daughter's information anymore.
Once a child dies, even the fact of your parenthood didn't carry any legal weight?
No. Now, we've been told...
I don't buy that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we've been told that, I mean, basically, if we brought this before a court, it would be very... Any judge would be hard-pressed to say that with the death of a child, a parent is no longer a parent. But there have been so many other issues to press forward on that that's just one of many.
Of many. What do you see as the solution to this kind of treatment, which apparently is ongoing in Alberta's foster care system? You managed to get the act changed. You managed to get children who were fostered simply for support separated from children who were fostered for protection.
That's right.
And you tell me that legislation apparently has been passed that children no longer have to be fostered even for supports, but in fact this isn't happening in practice. It must be the power of the Children's Aid. I mean, their need for funding that is driving the pressure to put children into foster care as opposed to supporting them at home. It must be cheaper, in fact, to support them at home.
From the studies I've looked into, it actually is less expensive. It would be more cost-effective to try and maintain a placement at home with the proper supports than it is to provide care out of home with a stranger who may not have the same invested for the child. Yes, the law, the legislation that was changed is called the Family Support for Children with Disabilities Program. This is to have separate legislation from that of Child Protection Services. This is Section 2, Manual Amendments, Policies, Procedures, and Family-Centered Supports and Services.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that this Alberta legislation will set precedents and being adopted across Canada, because it's my understanding that
it's not yet passed in Alberta.
This is right. This is just the tip of the iceberg. This is happening across Canada. It's happening across the U.S.
Right.
Families with children with disabilities are just totally being disregarded. And I think a lot of it has to do with an archaic perspective towards people with disabilities.
Those who necessarily suffer, yes.
Right, we're still not used to inclusion, and now that inclusion is being more and more seen in society, our legislation is not following along the examples. Neither are half the people within the FSCD program itself haven't been alerted that there is a differentiation now.
Yeah.
So it takes education, it really does, in order to avert disaster, and that's all we're really seeking, is to make sure that this doesn't happen to somebody else.
And yet in the last 3 weeks it's happened to two or three other children.
Yes.
In Alberta.
Yes.
And that doesn't count the other provinces.
Yes.
Where do people who are concerned go from here? Raise Their Voice, I guess. That's the name of our fundraiser, actually. Raise Your Voice.
And, Raise Your Voice.
Yeah.
But that becomes a dilemma for not only victims, but also the media, when there is a publication ban generally imposed upon victims. How is anyone to speak? How many other children have actually died, but nobody knows about them?
Well, if they impose a publication ban on the victim was the child. Do you mean they imposed one on you?
Well, yes. Once a child, if a child has received any sort of government supports and services, automatically there is a publication ban which disallows anyone from speaking about the child, the circumstances, etc. We've been posing the question to the minister, well, ministers. There, we've seen a turnover of 3 ministers since our child has passed, so you end up being back at square one explaining your story.
Right.
And we said, you know, our daughter did not fit the mandate of a child who was in need of protection. So thus, the publication ban doesn't follow. Our family wants to speak about our daughter. Our daughter is deceased. There's nothing that can harm her. She's with God now. She's well.
Mm-hmm.
So releasing her name is not going to harm her.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was informed by the minister's executive assistant that there is no publication ban regards to my daughter, Samantha Martin. I was told that last week, last Wednesday, by Margaret Mullenkamp. And I sent a letter to ensure that this was factual and gave a time limit to respond, and nobody's responded. So I believe they've legally waived their rights.
Yeah. Do you think a group representing parents concerned for disabled children would be an aid to this process of protecting and educating the public and the parents?
Certainly. The more education that's available to get word out, until one is actually touched by a story individually, I don't think we really realize how much is going on. I had really no political involvement, no advocacy. All of a sudden, this is sort of thrown on people, and that seems to be the case of other victims. All of a sudden, it's your individual stories, and then you realize that this opens up a very large can of worms that a lot of other people have been facing as well.
Yeah, an odd thing happens with these stories. All my stories stay up indefinitely on the web, the courtesy of RadioForAll.net, and as they stay up, they accumulate more and more listeners. Some of my shows have over 400 listeners now, and I know that includes a number of radio stations as well. But these shows start off very slow, with a low number of downloads. A couple of radio stations, I'm sure, but like individual downloads, a lot of people appear not to want to know. It is disturbing.
Absolutely, that's very true. I'm aware of a family there in the United States whose child with severe autism was harmed, gravely harmed. His caretaker threw bleach in his face.
Amen.
Yes, because it was about toileting, actually.
Okay.
And this poor boy was burnt, severely burnt.
Yeah.
The mother displayed pictures of her son, and
was he blinded?
No. Fortunately not. He will be healed, and I believe the person who harmed him and persons will be facing charges.
All right.
But when the mother tried to educate the public by placing his photographs up on the screen, on the computer screen, she received some very negative feedback from people who said, those pictures are horrific. We don't want to see those. Take those down. That's disgusting.
Instead of this act is disgusting, what happened to your child is disgusting.
Absolutely. It totally negated the fact of, you know what, you can bury your head in the sand, but this is really happening to these children, and somebody, as ugly as it is, you need to recognize it so you can put an end to it.
Yeah. Was there anything else that you wanted to say in this interview that we haven't covered, or to sum up?
Accountability. I just want to see that my child's life matters beyond my family, that the government will take some type of accountability and say to us, yes, your child, despite having a disability, she was a little girl primarily, and she matters, and we are going to do our best to ensure justice for her. That's what I'd like.
Thanks,
Barbara. I don't want this to happen to anyone else.
Yeah, we'd like the same thing in Ontario.
These children don't have a voice. Somebody has to be their voice.
Yeah, I've realized recently that the helpless, the vulnerable of all ages are taken advantage of in our system with the same lack of recourse to aids. But the elderly have the opportunity to open their eyes if they choose to, and they have time to deal with the issue. And they have demographics on their side as the baby boom swells and moves into old age. But the children, they just walk into it, you know, cold. They don't have any help. They don't have any voice. They don't have any experience, and they can't imagine what's going to happen to them.
No, that's true. It's a very vulnerable group. And for the elderly, too. Elder abuse. The thing is, you know, and I've tried to put across to authorities as well, we each, in our own time, will experience the same.
Yes.
It'll either come to us in our own old age, it'll come to us disability, and breaking down of the body will come as either through a loved one, through an accident, through But we, none of us are infallible, and it will happen to us as well. So it's really important. This is not just one small sector. We're not just looking at children with disabilities. We're looking at a large scope. And as baby boomers, we're all going to be in that position very soon.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think people want to see that, but it is, it is going to happen. We are going to get there.
We are. And we need to make sure that laws are in place to look after vulnerable people now before we are there.
Very good point. Thanks, Velvet.
Jeff, thank you very much for, as I say, for trying to expose this issue. This is imperative. It, as I say, it's not going to affect just one sector. It's going to be a lot of people.
Well, it's going to be all of us if we're lucky enough to live that long.
Yeah.
All right,
absolutely.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now it's time for Disrespect's Review of the News. These are not the stories that we read to you from the papers. These are abbreviations of the stories. The stories themselves go to the papers that we refer to in the newscast. Globe and Mail, Reuters. Secondhand smoke linked to thicker arteries in children. Children as young as 13 who have evidence of secondhand smoke in their blood also have visibly thicker arteries, Finnish researchers reported. Their study suggests that the damage caused by secondhand tobacco smoke starts in childhood and causes measurable damage by the teen years. Although previous research has found that passive smoke may be harmful for blood vessels among adults, we did not know until this study that these specific effects also happen among children and adolescents. Katarina Kallio of the University of Turku in Finland, who led the study, said in a statement. Her team studied 494 children aged 8 to 13 taking part in ongoing research on heart disease. They measured levels of cotinine, a byproduct of nicotine that is found in the blood after someone breathes in tobacco smoke. Ultrasound was used to measure the thickness of the aorta and of the carotid artery in the neck. The aorta is the largest artery in the body, originating from the left ventricle of the heart and extending down to the abdomen where it branches off. The carotid artery supplies the head and neck with oxygenated blood. Artery walls look thicker on an ultrasound if they are damaged by the process of atherosclerosis. The World Lung Foundation and the American Cancer Society jointly project that tobacco use will kill 6 million people next year from cancer, heart disease, emphysema, and other ills, with direct medical costs to the global economy of $500 billion U.S. dollars a year. In their Cancer Atlas, available at www.tobaccoatlas.org, the group say that 1 billion men and 250 million women globally smoke daily. And in more news regarding children, new benefit is discriminatory. Letters at thespectator.com. This letter by Sally Palmer, chair of the Social Action Committee, Ontario Association of Social Workers, Hamilton and District Branch. Regarding Minister, Families Better Off with New Benefit, March 5th. Laurel Broughton, Minister of Children and Youth Services, gives a misleading impression that children and families on social assistance are benefiting from the Ontario Child Benefit to the same degree as children in working families. Broughton states that a single mom receiving Ontario Works with two children aged 5 and 7 has an income $1,100 higher than in 2008. This would be $550 per child. Her colleague, Madeleine Meunier, Minister of Community and Social Services, told the Ontario Legislature, speaking about the OCB, "We have advanced this investment this year, so they are receiving $1,100. It is working families who are receiving $1,100 per year per child, while those on social assistance receive much less. When the Ontario Child Benefit was introduced in 2008, the government began to claw back money from social assistance checks. They took away two mandatory benefits, rolling them into the OCB, the back-to-school and winter clothing allowances, which together were worth either $184 or $245 per year, depending on the child's age. When they increased the Ontario Child Benefit in 2009, they again clawed back a significant amount from the basic needs allowance of the parents' check. Parents of older children were left with an increase of only $1 per month per child, compared to the $42 increase given to working parents. Children in families on social assistance, the poorest in Ontario, are not benefiting equally from the Ontario Child Benefit. They and their parents are being told, in effect, quote, "You don't deserve this," unquote. Globe and Mail by Kelly Grant and Anna Mailer Paperny. Overlooking urban centers lacks vision, Miller says. Beset by its own financial troubles, the City of Toronto found no relief in the federal government's austere new budget. Toronto Mayor David Miller called the Conservatives' latest fiscal blueprint a missed opportunity to invest in the national transit, child care, and social housing strategies he and other big city leaders have been demanding for years. Quote, "This budget doesn't show a vision of this country and how it's going to ensure that Canada succeeds, particularly in its great cities," Mr. Miller said. Ryerson University professor Meyer Siemiatkowski said a federal government looking to jumpstart the national post-recession economy neglects urban investment at its peril. "The economic competitiveness of Canada hinges increasingly on the viability of its cities," he said, adding the budget is evidence of a disconnect between the federal conservatives and urban voters. While some men running to replace Mr. Miller seem to qualify their concern, Ward 19 councillor and mayoral candidate Joe Pantalone also felt the budget was lacking, especially on commitment to public transit. Quote, "And I say that because the transportation is one of our biggest problems in this area, and we all know that transit is the solution." Globe and Mail, Thursday, February 25th, 2010. "Talented CEO's move is another nail in the coffin of health networks," by Adam Radwanski. Like most people, Matt Anderson has good reasons for changing jobs. He's seeking new challenges and a chance to broaden his experience. He's looking forward to a shorter commute. A big pay increase is probably part of it as well, though he's not so crass as to mention it. But Mr. Anderson's colleagues in the healthcare sector are reading much more into his decision. His departure from Toronto's regional health authority to take a job as a hospital CEO is seen as another nail in the coffin of Ontario's beleaguered local health integration networks. With little real power over the hospitals they're supposed to be overseeing, the 14 networks set up during Dalton McGuinty's first term have had trouble attracting strong leadership. That's a huge problem because the only way they can make much progress toward a more seamless and efficient system is if their leaders show strong initiative and personally command respect. Until last week, Mr. Anderson was held up by Health Insiders as a rare beacon of hope. A highly respected young executive who had worked his way up through the ranks of the University Health Network, which controls three of Toronto's biggest downtown hospitals, he was widely seen as one of healthcare's rising stars by 2008. So there was considerable surprise when he took over as CEO of the Toronto Central Lynn. But the hope wasn't just that Mr. Anderson would tower over everyone else, it was that his lead would be followed by other up-and-comers. But now, leaving Toronto Central after less than 2 years, he's sending another message. He acknowledges he'd initially been uncertain about the prospects of working for the networks, but insists he's now bullish about them. He told health executives the same thing mere days before his departure, but during that speech he briefly touched upon the new system's inherent weakness. Of the $4.2 billion budget nominally administered by the Toronto Central, he said the Lynn only has about $12 million in discretionary funding. In healthcare, as in most other fields, power rests mostly where the money is. The ministry has power because it still makes most of the big picture funding decisions. The hospitals have power because they still decide where most of their funding is allocated, and the Lynns are left struggling to be anything more than an extra layer of bureaucracy between the two. It's no wonder, then, that Mr. Anderson has gone off to run the William Osler Health Center, a place where, overseeing the Brampton Civic, Peel Memorial, and Etobicoke General Hospitals, he'll have direct control over an annual operating budget of about $260 million. The fact remains he's leaving a job where he was theoretically overseeing health care at the center of the biggest city in the country to run three suburban hospitals. So how can Lynns in more remote regions possibly expect to recruit the best and brightest? Mr. Anderson will probably be able to do more good for patients in his new job, but an army of policy experts argues the key to healthcare sustainability is regional coordination rather than having hospitals operate as silos. It's more obvious than ever that the current model won't achieve that. And from the Associated Press, Right to Die advocates indicted in Georgia. A North Georgia grand jury said four members of a Right to Die group, the Final Exit Network, operated a criminal enterprise that helped people die. An indictment returned charges the Final Exit Network, along with co-founder Thomas Ted Goodwin, 64, Claire Blair, 77, Dr. Lawrence Egbert, 82, and Nicholas Alex Sheridan, 61, with violating Georgia's RICO Act, assisting a suicide and tampering with evidence. The four are to be arraigned in Forsyth County Superior Court on April 1st. The indictment, the first of its kind in Georgia, was returned more than a year after the four were arrested for allegedly helping John Selmer, 58, die by breathing helium pumped into a plastic hood secured over his head. District Attorney Penny Penn said Selmer's death and the planned death of the agent were the basis for the racketeering charge. A racketeering conviction could bring up to 20 years in prison. Tampering with evidence has a maximum punishment of 10 years in prison, and assisting a suicide carries a 5-year prison sentence. The Final Exit Network promotes on its website our right to die a peaceful and painless death at the time and place of our choosing. And again from the Globe and Mail, Kirk Macon, justice reporter. Violent police tactic used in murder case ruled excessive. Courts across Canada confused by judge's decision, Crown lawyers and police say. An investigative technique that uses violence and intimidation to crack cases has been thrown into doubt after an Ontario judge ruled that police used it to illegally assault and threaten a murder suspect. The judge concluded that senior Toronto police mistakenly believed they had the authority to commit serious crimes during their investigation of a torture murder case in Toronto's Flemington Park area. The 273-page ruling by Mr. Justice Brian Trafford of Ontario Superior Court has prompted several police forces, including Toronto Police and the Ontario Provincial Police, to suspend their use of the so-called stimulation technique. It also caused the Ontario Crown and Toronto Police Service this week to ask the Supreme Court of Canada to schedule a critically important appeal of the decision as soon as possible. In a written brief, lawyers for the Crown and police warned that the ruling has created unfortunate confusion and uncertainty in the police community and in criminal trial cases across the country. Clarity of the law in this regard is highly desirable in the interests of ongoing public safety. The Flemington Park operation was hatched by a team of homicide officers who had been stymied by what Judge Trafford termed a culture of fear, intimidation, and reprisal during their investigation of the murder of Omar Wellington. According to the plan, two officers were to masquerade as Jamaican hitmen sent by Mr. Wellington's father to avenge the killing. On January 24, 2007, the undercover officers entered a local community center. As one of them stood guard, the other grabbed the target suspect by his lapels, shoved him against a wall, and warned that he would be killed if the hitmen could not locate and kill two of his confederates. The youth promptly called several friends. Police, who had prearranged wiretaps on their phones, obtained the statements they needed to charge five men with murder. However, the operation almost misfired when some of the youths went hunting for the purported hitmen. Police quickly flooded the area to ensure that innocent civilians were not gunned down by mistake. At trial, defense lawyers argued that police had gone overboard in applying Criminal Code Section 25.1, a new, relatively untested provision that gives police broad immunity from prosecution if they commit crimes during an investigation. The defense argued that the police had misread the law, believing it granted them prior authorization to commit grave criminal acts. Judge Trafford agreed that police breached the Charter of Rights. However, he refused to throw out the wiretap evidence on the basis that it could cause the public to lose faith in the justice system. Again, the Globe and Mail. Cruel, unusual trial. prosecuting a suicidal, impoverished, blind man in Thunder Bay for failing to stop his wife from killing herself is an almost sadistic use of state powers. Having kept Peter Fontis, 47, in jail for 70 days after he was charged and wrung a guilty plea out of him for criminal negligence causing death, Ontario Justice now aims to put him behind bars for another 9 months. How any of this judicial piling on serves the public interest is beyond comprehension. The story of Mr. Fontis and his late wife, Yanisa Fontis, is one of the tragedies of last year's recession. If not for the cruel intervention of the state, it would probably have remained mostly unknown. Mrs. Fontis, as a child, was sexually abused by her mother and allowed to be sexually abused by others. Mr. Fontis, a child of a single mother, had a brother taken away by child protection workers, and before they could be reunited, the brother was killed in a car accident. Estranged from their families and communities, they found love and understanding in each other, a small miracle. Like many of the poor, they moved around to find work. Ms. Fontis was working as a supply chain analyst at Loblaws in Waterloo, Ontario, when she was let go. He did not work. They were socially isolated. She could not find another job. Ultimately, they landed in a Thunder Bay motel. She took her life by overdose, and when he was sure she was dead, he tried 3 times to take his own life, including hanging himself with a belt and drowning himself. Why prosecute a man who, as a free individual in circumstances he found unbearable, entered into what appears to have been a suicide pact? There is no evidence he induced a vulnerable partner to kill herself. They were roughly equal partners in their despair. Why was Peter Fontis held in jail for more than 2 months after being charged? Blind and poor, was he a danger to flee the jurisdiction? Of course not. He was a man with nowhere to go and no one to take him in. Was he a danger to society? Hardly. And why, after his 3 failed suicide attempts and after the death of the spouse who he felt gave meaning to his life, does the justice system seek to punish him further? To deter other suicidal, abused, and impoverished people from entering suicide pacts? Nonsense. This is not justice. This is the all-powerful state punishing the poor for having constrained choices. It is the state acting with neither humanity nor mercy. That was an editorial from the Globe and Mail. And on a little brighter note, Ontario now paying for breast cancer test. Globe and Mail, Tuesday, March 9th, by Lisa Priest. Ontario has begun funding a molecular test that can tell a breast cancer patient whether they can safely skip chemotherapy and save the healthcare system an estimated $10,000 in unnecessary treatment. The new practice, which began last month, came after the Globe and Mail reported in December that 130 Canadian women had paid out of pocket to undergo the Oncotype DX test in the United States because it was not covered here. The test analyzes 21 genes that can help predict whether a cancer is likely to return within the next decade. Health Ministry spokesman David Jensen said the move is recognition that the $3,975 U.S. test, $3,975 U.S., was not available in the province and should be covered. He said bulletins explaining the process of applying for out-of-country funding are mailed to all physicians and are posted on the ministry website. As of March 2nd, he said fewer than 5 Ontario applicants have received Health Ministry approval for the tests, which are done in Redwood City, California. However, doctors interviewed said they had had more cases approved than that. Sandy Sadev, a medical oncologist at William Osler Health Center in Brampton, said he knew of a further 6 cases in his office alone. We heard through the grapevine that one doctor tried it and got funding for it, so we tried it. It's been very reassuring for patients, Dr. Sadev said. Maureen Trudeau, head of medical oncology and hematology at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, said doctors aren't sending everybody's tumor for testing, but we are asking for approval in cases where it would make a difference. Each year, more than 12,000 Canadian women find themselves in this medical gray zone. The test removes the medical guesswork on how best to treat breast cancer patients whose tumors look identical under a microscope but have wildly different outcomes despite undergoing the same treatment. For For patients in the rest of Canada, those eligible can obtain the test for free on a clinical trial at 22 sites. That study, part of a wider analysis of 11,000 people in several countries, is looking at how best to treat patients who have an intermediate score on the test and how the test works overall. Those not eligible must pay out of pocket or try to persuade their health authorities or provinces to fund the test. Globe and Mail again. Gautam Naik. The tobacco plant's growing place in the fight against H1N1. The U.S. Department of Defense, caught off guard by the swift spread of the H1N1 flu virus last year and delays in producing a vaccine, is backing an unusual plan to use tobacco plants to make the vaccine. Flu vaccines are typically grown in chicken eggs. Although the technique is slow and expensive, vaccine makers have done little to improve on this reliable method for more than 60 years. The urgent need for a better way became apparent last year. The response to H1N1 was a disaster, said Brett Girard, Vice Chancellor for Research at Texas A&M University System, part of a consortium testing plant-based vaccines for H1N1 or swine flu. But the GreenVax project still has a long way to go. It needs to show that it can produce sufficient quantities of purified vaccine-ready protein quickly and safely. And such a vaccine would have to be tested in humans and get the approval of the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. before it can be provided more widely. Globe and Mail, Wednesday, March 3rd. By Kate Hammer in the Globe and Mail Education Reporter. High-need students make connections. Critics say better ministry funding model could help more children with learning disabilities. Bells trilled as 15-year-old Gabriel Pacheco rocked nervously from side to side. Slight shifts in his movement changed the pitch and rhythm of the music. He was standing in front of his school's Sound Bee machine, a therapy tool used for children with autism. A grin stretched across Gabriel's face when he realized it was his own movement that controlled the music. That's an important connection for them to make, the one between their actions and the environment, said Sheena Matheson, the principal at Lucy McCormick Senior School, a school for high-need students located near Dundas Street West and DuPont Street. The Toronto District School Board has struggled to find schools like Lucy McCormick where the highest need students congregate and can gain access to resources like the Sound Beam. Experts say the problem is bigger than a need for more money. It's rooted in the dated funding model the Ministry of Education uses to dish out dollars to the boards, leaving budgetary shortfalls for everything from special education to librarians and guidance counselors. The funding model was developed more than a decade ago when student needs and demographics were very different, and the Ministry of Education has long promised to review it in 2010. But with a new minister in control and spring around the corner, a growing chorus of board officials and educators from across the province are calling on the ministry to make good on its promise. Even though there have been a number of patches and changes to the model over the years, it's definitely time for a full review, said Annie Kidder, Executive Director of People for Education. An outdated model can limit programs and staffing, Ms. Kidder said, as funding for support such as librarians and guidance counselors is built on a per-pupil allocation. Ms. Kidder's group found that with the current model, only 3% of elementary schools can generate enough funding for a full-time librarian, and only 80% of high schools can fund a full-time guidance counselor. It makes it very difficult to provide a rich array of programs in school in 2010 that are much smaller than they were in 1997, Ms. Kidder said. Wrapping up the news, Globe and Mail, Thursday, February 18th. A giggle a day keeps the ticker in play, by Maria Cheng in London. You've heard it before, to avoid a heart attack, don't smoke, eat right and exercise, but it also may help to be happy, a new study says. Even if you're grumpy by nature, just try to be cheerful. Researchers at Columbia University rated the happiness levels of more than 1,700 adults in Canada with no heart problems in 1995. After a decade, they examined the 145 people who developed a heart problem and found happier people were less likely to have had one. The study was published online in the European Heart Journal. If you aren't a naturally happy person, just try acting like one, said Karina Davidson of the Columbia University Medical Center, the paper's lead author. It could help your heart. Dr. Davidson said happy people were more likely to have a healthier lifestyle. It could also be there is an unknown genetic trait that predisposes people to be happy and have less heart disease. Other experts said happiness itself could result in a healthier heart compared to other emotions such as stress or depression. Stress often releases hormones that can damage heart muscles. Stress can also cause blood vessels to open too wide, allowing plaque buildups to break off and clog the arteries, according to Jep Perk, a professor of health sciences at Sweden's Kalmar University. He was not linked to the study. Anything that patients can do to increase the amount of happiness in their lives will be helpful, said Dr. Davidson, adding there was a slight proviso. No smoking, eating unhealthy food, not exercising, or anything potentially damaging, she said. That's the only trick.
On the piano, Henry Gray, Gray's Bounce. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.